This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Today's episode includes a graphic and horrific story about the death of an individual. If this sort of thing upsets you, this is definitely not the episode for you.
Welcome to Mayhem in the Morgue with your host, Dr. Kendall Crowns.
Today's episode, Ghost Stories. Happy Halloween from Mayhem in the Morgue. People think that something special happens at the morgue on this day, but sadly, nothing really ever does. The dead don't rise up from their body bags, portals to hell don't open up in the bathrooms, and there are no ghostly voices crying out from the cooler. All in all, it's just like any other day. Nothing special. Maybe someone dies in a costume, but beyond that, it's the same. The same as it ever was. Today, for Halloween, I'm going to talk about a few ghostly encounters that I have had, and one gruesome Halloween story. I am not one for ghosts. I do enjoy haunted houses, though, but that's different because it's not real and they can't touch you. I actually find the paranormal something that I stay away from. My brother used to scare me as a child with stories about the Amityville Horror and The Exorcist. Shows like Ghost Hunters and Destination Fear will keep me up at night, so I avoid them. I try not to get involved in the debate about ghosts, whether they're real or not real. But sometimes, no matter what I do, you just can't skirt the issue. At the Cook County Medical Examiner's Office in Chicago, Illinois, the topic would occasionally come up, and we would get into a debate about the office being haunted. I would always say that people don't die here, so why would they haunt a morgue? The very element of ghost stories is the person haunts the place they died at. I have stayed at haunted places like the Stanley Hotel in Boulder, Colorado, but those places, at least someone had been murdered there or died, and that's why they were haunted. But no one dies at the morgue. My coworkers would always argue back, "Oh no, there's ghost here. This place is haunted." But they never had any proof. There's no blood coming from the walls, lights flickering for no reason, and no small children saying, "They're here." And again, I never saw ghosts there. Except this one time where I had a very eerie experience early in the morning. I used to have to take the train from the suburbs where I lived into the city, and then I would walk from the train station to the L and take the L to get close to where I worked. My daily commute would start around 4 a.m. Sometimes when I would get to the office, I would be exhausted, especially in the winter time, and I would take a nap by rolling up my jacket and laying down on the floor and using the jacket as a pillow. One time when I was napping on the floor in this manner, I started hearing this weird, echoey baby cry somewhere off in the distance. I couldn't figure out where it was coming from. My office was on the second floor of the medical examiner's office, and when I came down to the morgue that day to start doing autopsies, I found out there were three dead babies in the cooler waiting to be autopsied. I told one of my coworkers, "Wow, I heard a baby crying earlier when I was upstairs." And they said, "See? This place is haunted, and now you've experienced it. There's no denying it now. It's just like a graveyard." And I again argued. I didn't know exactly what I had heard, and I had been asleep. So who knows? I thought it might be a baby crying, but again, the baby didn't die here. I thought it was ridiculous. I believe the story goes that ghosts haunt graveyards because that's where their body is, and their spirit stays close to their body. So again, the medical examiner's office is just the way station to the afterlife, because their body is only there temporarily before it's shipped to the next place. I did not think the crying baby was a ghost. I've thought about this over the years, trying to explain what I heard, and my best theory is I had an infant son at the house at that time. He didn't like to sleep through the night. My wife and I were constantly tired from always being awake. And maybe I was just so tired that I thought I was hearing crying because that's all I ever heard at night at home, and it wasn't anything at all. It was just a dream because I was so sleepy. Who knows? But I'm pretty sure it wasn't a ghost. People say ghosts haunt places for a number of reasons. It may have been a place that they frequented or had meaning to them, It may have been a place where they spent most of their lives, or it might have been a place where they died suddenly or unexpectedly. One thing is, a hospital can be one of those places, and one of the hospitals I worked at was believed to be haunted. When I began my third year of medical school, my first rotation was in surgery. I spent 2 months being assigned patients that I would take care of, see their surgeries, and help them recover. The last patient I was assigned before I finished my rotation was a patient by the name of Linda Turner. She had been admitted to the hospital for abdominal swelling over a short period of time. When I came in to evaluate her, she was a 54-year-old woman with short black hair and brown eyes. She was incredibly nice, smiling, and pleasant. Her abdomen was markedly swollen, and she said it made her look like she was pregnant. And she told me, "That ain't a possibility for me anymore." And when I looked at her abdomen, it was very swollen. She was a thin woman, and it looked like she had swallowed a small beach ball. The overlying skin was stretched, tight, and when I palpated her abdomen, it was as hard as a rock, which is a major red flag. I told the findings to my surgery attending, and he had me order some tests and a CT scan, and he had Mrs. Turner admit it. It took a few days to get her into the CT scanner, and every day I would come by to see how she was doing. She would always be awake in the morning and would want to talk a little while. She was kind and funny. We would talk about her travels, her daughters, game shows, and just how bad the hospital food was. I would also come by in the afternoon to check on her before I went home for the day. She would be tired and probably in pain, but she always had a smile and always enjoyed talking. The abdominal swelling and pain that she was experiencing was quite concerning because she had had pancreatic cancer in the past. They had taken out most of her pancreas and part of her intestines. She had had chemotherapy and radiation, and they thought she was in remission. As a celebration for having beaten the cancer, Linda decided to do some traveling that she had always wanted to do. But after several months, she noticed that her abdomen was beginning to swell. She figured it was bad, spent a few more months doing what she wanted to do before she came into the hospital. When we finally got the CT scan, it did show there was a return of her cancer in the mesenteric fat, which is the fat around the intestines. But this was the 90s, so it wasn't definitive. It was decided by the surgeon to do an exploratory surgery and see how bad the cancer was. By the time the surgery was scheduled, it had been about a week in total since she had been admitted. And I had really gotten to know Linda, and I really liked her. On the day of her surgery, I met with her beforehand, and as always, she was positive and upbeat. She said to me, "I beat it once, and I'll beat it again." And I agreed. I got to be part of the surgery, but as a medical student, my job was to retract the incision with a big curved blade retractor and stand there and watch. When I walked into the operating room, Linda was draped and had her eyes taped shut. She didn't actually look real to me at that moment. The surgeon began the surgery and made an incision through her abdomen and told me to retract it open. I dutifully put my retractor into the incision and pulled it open. And when I did that, you could see it. The gray-white nodules of cancer were everywhere, infiltrating the soft tissue, the intestinal wall, the liver, the lymph nodes. There was nothing that could be done. The surgeon evaluated it, and he said, "There's nothing we can do. It's too far." And they closed the incision, and she was sent to recovery. It was a little late in the afternoon by this time, and I didn't stay around until she woke up, which I regret still to this day. I was sad that Linda, my friend, could not be saved. The next morning, I came into her hospital room to do my morning rounds. When Linda saw me, she had a big smile on her face, and she said, "Hey, hey, hey, Dr. K, what did they find?" And I looked at her, and I said, "Did no one discuss anything with you?" And she said, "Nope. By the time I woke up, everybody was gone except the nurses, and nobody had any information for me." Probably the reality of this is the surgeon had talked to her, but she was probably still groggy and just didn't remember, and her family members that were there were not in the room at the present time. She continued on saying, "You're the first one I've seen, so what's going on?" And I said to her, "It's probably best if the doctor or one of the residents talk it over with you." And she said, Now, come on, Kendall. We've known each other for a little while now. Tell me what's going on. It's bad, isn't it? At that moment, I started crying because I didn't know what to say. I had never told anyone they were going to die. I said to her, I'm just a student, and it's not my place to talk about it. And I just sat there crying. And she said, you know, if you're crying, it's obviously really bad. And I finally was able to say, well, it is. They couldn't do anything for you. Your cancer's too far. Linda pushed a box of tissues over to me that was on her bedside table and said, okay, get yourself cleaned up. And then she said, I guess that's just how it goes. We sat there for a few minutes while I calmed down. And then Linda said to me very calmly and matter-of-factly, you know, you're going to have to learn how to toughen up. Because if you want to be a doctor, you can't get upset just because someone's dying. That's just part of your job, and you have to be able to tell them straight without getting emotional about it. You have to figure out how to lock it away. I always look back at that moment, and it's sad that this person with terminal cancer was telling me to be tough. It should have been the other way around. Linda never got to go home. She continued to be my patient for the rest of my surgery rotation, and always continued to maintain her upbeat attitude, even though the inevitable was looming near at hand. She was eventually moved to the fifth floor on the east side of the hospital, to a corner room, where they put cancer patients who were terminal but weren't problematic. It had large windows that looked out into the parking lot that I was very familiar with, because a few years earlier I had pushed a dead body across it, and I could see the morgue where I worked when I was an autopsy technician before medical school. I would sit and talk to Linda, staring out this window and staring at that morgue, trying not to think about her dying. One morning I walked into the room. It was my last day of my surgery rotation, and I was not dressed in scrubs on that day, but I was dressed in dress clothes and a tie. When Linda saw me, she said to me, "My, my, my, aren't you fancy today, Dr. K? What's the occasion? I know you didn't get dressed up just for little old me." I told her that I had oral exams that afternoon, and today was my last day of my surgery rotation, and she would no longer be my patient, but I would still come by and see her. Her response to this was, "Well, I hope you do well on your examinations, and I'm glad you're going to still come back by and see me, but I will miss you as being my doctor." And then she said, "But I've got something to tell you, Kendall." It was this weird, fancy woman wearing a red silk bathrobe, red shoes, and a red bow in her hair. She walked through my room, stood at the foot of my bed, and looked at me, and said something. And then, she went into the bathroom, and she never came out. And she said while the woman in red was in her room, the room got really cold. I said to Linda, "That's really strange." And then Linda said, "Yes, I think she's still in there. Can you check?" And I thought to myself, well, this is incredibly odd. I went into the bathroom and I looked. There was no one in there. And Linda said, "Did you check the shower? I bet she's in the shower." And I looked in the shower, and again, nobody was to be found. Linda said, "That's so strange. I never saw her leave." We talked a little bit longer, we said our usual goodbyes, and I headed to the nurse's station to do my charting. I said to the nurses, "You know, it's bizarre, but Linda saw some woman in red walk through her room, stopped at the foot of her bed, and went into the bathroom. But there's no one there. Did she have visitors last night?" The nurses looked at each other, and one of them said, "Oh, she's seen the lady in red." And I said, "Well, who's the lady in red?" And the other nurse said, "She's the harbinger of death. She haunts this floor of the hospital, and every patient who sees her will die shortly thereafter. It's only a matter of time now for her." I finished filling out my chart and found my attending. I told him how Linda was doing, and then I said, "Oh, and by the way, she said she saw some lady in red last night." The surgery attending said, "Oh, she's seen the lady in red. Well, we're not going to have to worry about her much longer." And at that point, I tried to get information about who the lady in red was and why she was the harbinger of death for this floor of the hospital. I asked several people, nurses, doctors, janitors, librarians, even the nuns. But no one really knew the origin of her story, It's just she always was on that floor as long as anyone could remember, haunting it, haunting the patients that were near death. I found out that the hospital had been built in 1889, and there was no deaths associated with the hospital's construction, nor had there been any mysterious deaths or murders that occurred in the hospital in all the time that people could remember. The story of the lady in red had just been lost to time, and there was no explanation of why she haunted that particular floor or chose the patients that she would appear to. The next day, I started my dreaded obstetrics rotation, and on my first day, I was put on 24-hour call. I had to be part of a very eventful birth that I'll talk about in another episode, but later on in that day, I had a free moment, and I wandered over to the surgery floor to go see Linda and to check up on her. She wasn't my patient anymore, but that didn't matter. She was my friend, and I wanted to see how she was doing. When I got to her room, she was on a ventilator and unresponsive. This was incredibly upsetting to me. I went to the nurse's station and I asked what had happened. The nurses said that at around midnight, she had gone into a coma and had to be intubated, and the doctors had reached out to family to get a final opinion on what to do. But the nurses said, no matter what happens, it's only a matter of time now. The next day, I went by to check up on her, and when I was walking by the nurse's station, they stopped me, and they told me that Linda had died the evening before. Once again, the woman in red had claimed another victim. And that's the end of that story. Except, one thing was, I always kept my patient's information on little note cards that I kept in the breast pocket of my white coat. I carried Linda's card with me throughout the rest of medical school, and then throughout all of residency. And when I got done, I took that white coat off and never put it on again. I packed it up and it's somewhere in the attic, still probably with Linda's card in it. I've never forgotten her. She was one of my most favorite patients, and still brings me great sadness to think about her. But I took her advice to heart, and I have always tried to keep my emotions out of my work. But let's move on. This is Halloween, after all. We need something less sad, but far more creepy. Every forensic pathologist has their favorite story to tell, and some, like myself, have favorites from different categories, including holidays. So with Halloween looming on the horizon, we'll end the show with a far more Halloween-centered, creepy story. This story isn't mine, though. It's from one of my long-since-dead mentors. He shared this story with me because he was excited about a case that I had had. He had had something very similar, almost exactly the same, but his case had occurred on Halloween. My actual most creepy story is far too upsetting for any media. It's something that I'll probably never be able to share, because it's just too out there to be believed. Maybe one day I'll put it in a book or something. But for now, we're going to discuss this case, which occurred in a suburb of a large southern city. It was Halloween, and the neighborhood was in full spooky mode. Pumpkins, monsters, and skeletons were on full display. This was in the 80s, so there was less hyper-realistic gore available to decorate with. No zombie babies or glowing red-eyed animatronics, but some people still made an attempt to make it scary. It was nighttime, and the streetlights had turned on. Kids were out trick-or-treating, dressed in costumes of monsters, movie stars, and other assorted characters. Homes handing out candy were lit with porch lights and cheerful, glowing pumpkins sitting on hay bales. And of course, there is always one house with a take-one candy bowl that is emptied by the first marauding trick-or-treater, probably dressed as a pirate. Some of the homeowners sat on the porch or in their driveway, hanging out with neighbors or sitting with their spouses, greeting trick-or-treaters with a jovial, happy Halloween. The neighborhood was alive with festive Halloween spirit and fun. But there was one house at the end of the street that was a little different. It was not as well maintained as the other homes in the neighborhood. The flower beds had weeds, and the yard had patchy dry areas of grass and dead spots with dirt. The only porch light flickered in the darkness, creating a slight strobing effect. The owner of the home was an elderly woman who had lived in the neighborhood for decades and was well known and well liked by her neighbors. She was a widow, with her husband having died years ago. Her middle-aged son still lived with her. He had lived there his entire life. To anyone's recollection, he had never left the area. He didn't drive, They knew he worked somewhere around town, but they weren't sure. He was a little odd, but pleasant. There was never any trouble with him. He always was benign and kept to himself. On this Halloween night, he sat in the strobing light of the porch in his grandmother's old wood rocking chair. He was a big guy. He was 6'2", about 300 pounds, with a tight, flat top haircut. He stared out intensely into the night, rocking slowly back and forth, waiting for trick-or-treaters. He had two small tables on either side of him. One had a ceramic bowl full of candy, Reese's peanut butter cups, Baby Ruths, and blow pops. The other table had a prominent Halloween decoration on it, the star of the show, so to say. Most kids were too spooked to go up to get candy, but the braver kids would walk up. They would excitedly say trick-or-treat, and he would reach into the bowl and hand out candy, saying Happy Halloween. The kids and adults would compliment him on his minimalist, but still creepy costume and decorations. And when they asked who he was dressed as, he would respond, slightly confused, and say, "Me." His costume consisted of a rumpled white t-shirt, blue denim pants, and black boots. The shirt had wide bloodstains across the abdomen, and the pants and boots had blood spatters all over them. He had blood on the side of his face, extending from his forehead across the side of his cheek. He also had blood on his forearms and caking his hands. There were bloody footprints leading from the house to where he sat. He really put effort into making it look creepy, and it was quite gory and very realistic. His white candy bowl had bloody fingerprints on it, and the candy wrappers were also stained with droplets of blood. One adult said, "You've really gone all out with that fake blood. Don't leave it on too long, though, because you might get a rash." His response was just a creepy smile. People also complimented him on his very real-looking decoration, sitting on the other table next to him. When one child went to touch it, he blocked them and said, "Oh, don't do that. She wouldn't like that." What was this decoration? The decoration was that of a human head. Long gray hair, the eyes and mouth closed, and there were still earrings in the ears. The head had a waxy look to it, but overall, it looked incredibly realistic. It had a lot of fake blood on it, in the hair, and along the stump of the neck, so much so that it was oozing down the side of the table. A couple of the adults that had ventured up onto the patio asked what he sculpted it out of, which he calmly replied, "Yes." After a while, a group of neighborhood kids came to retrieve their candy from him. They had a couple of moms keeping track of them. I don't know what the kids' costumes were, but I always like to think they were dressed as Smurfs, because it just makes it a little bit more absurd. The moms followed the kids up on the porch, and when the kids were getting their candy, one of the moms looked at the decoration in the strobing light and gasped. She turned to the other mom and said, "Oh my, that's Carol," which is not her actual name because I don't really know what it was. The other mom quickly recognized the head as Carol, the woman of the house, the mom of the man handing out the candy. The kids had gotten their candy and were complaining about the sticky blood on the wrappers, but they quickly took off to the next house to get more candy. The two moms quickly followed after them, while the man continued to sit in the rocking chair, waiting for the next group of kids. The moms quickly herded the group of children to the area where several of the neighbors had set up a table to hand out candy. The kids were complaining because they wanted to continue on, but the moms told them to be quiet, and they gathered the group of neighbors and told them what they saw, to which several people didn't believe it. They debated, should others go check? Should they make sure it was really a human head? Should they make sure it's Carol, or is it someone else? Because, you know, they hadn't seen Mike all evening. Should they just confront him? And unlike a horror movie, one of the more reasonable neighbors said, "Forget that, let's call the police." And that's what they did. And when the police arrived, they walked up to the man still sitting in the rocker, and they said to him, "Good evening, sir. That's a nice Halloween decoration you have there." To which the man said, "Why, thank you." And then one of the officers said, "Where did you get it from?" And the man said, "Oh, that's my mom." The officers were taken aback by that. And one said, "Okay, what happened to her?" And the man said, "I killed her, and then I cut off her head." The officers were startled and paused and said, "Okay, are we going to have any trouble here? "Where is the rest of her?" And the man said, "I won't be any trouble at all, sir." "I don't want to be. I don't want to create problems. Oh, and the rest of her? Well, it's in the house, laying on the floor." "I can take you there and show you if you'd like." The officers said, "Well, yes, let's go see her." And he stood up, and the officers stood on either side of him. And he led them into the house, and sure enough, there was the rest of the man's mom laying on the floor of the foyer with about 20 to 30 stab wounds and a large kitchen knife protruding from her back. And her head had been completely cut off. There was blood all over the floor around her and on the walls, and it had been obviously walked through at some point. When they cuffed him and were putting him in the police car, they asked him, why did he murder his mother? And he said, "Well, you know, he needed to do that because he thought she was possessed by the devil, or maybe aliens, or possibly the CIA. He wasn't sure, but she was definitely possessed." And they took him downtown, where he was processed. He had fully admitted to what he had done. He had obvious mental problems, and he was put away in a mental health facility for the rest of his life, to my knowledge. And when he was asked why he put his mom's head on the table, he said, "Well, she would like to see all the costumes because, you know, she really loved Halloween and loved being part of the festivities." And he didn't want to deny her of that. I mean, of course, that makes complete sense. There's one more thing about this case, and that is, my oldest daughter used the story for her 8th grade theater arts class. The assignment was to write a short, scary play based on their own story for Halloween. She came home and asked if I had any good scary stories. I provided her with two, this case and another case about a taco expedition that went horribly wrong, which I will talk about in a future episode. Of course, this story was by far the creepiest one, and she created a play based on it. She was sick of fake stories and wanted something real that people should be afraid of. When she presented it to her class, she did a one-girl version of the story, acting out the parts, using a ruler for a knife, and reenacting the decapitation using a ball falling to the floor. She closed the story with a chilling, "And it's true." The teacher stood silent, blinking. None of the kids spoke. It was dead silent. The teacher broke the silence and said, "That's a true story?" To which my daughter said, "Yes, yes it is. My dad told me this one. The kids in her class knew me because of my career day talks, so they knew it wasn't fake." And one of the kids in the class said, "I think I'm going to be sick." The teacher said to her, "Well, wow, that's just too intense for middle school, really high school, probably even college. I think we better go with something else." And it ended up they decided to go with a play based on the urban legend of the licked hand. And if you don't know what that one is, it's a story about a girl home alone for the first time with only her dog as company. She hears news about some random serial killer being on the loose in the neighborhood and, of course, locks all the doors but forgets to lock one window in the basement. She goes to bed with her trusted dog in the room sleeping underneath the bed. She, of course, wakes up in the middle of the night because she keeps hearing this dripping sound coming from the bathroom, but she's too afraid to check on it. And she reaches down to pet the dog and gets a reassuring lick from the dog on her hand. The next day, when she gets up, she walks into the bathroom and finds the dog dead and mutilated, hanging in the shower, with a message written in the dog's blood on the wall saying, "Humans can lick too." And that's the end of the story. My daughter feels still to this day that her story was far superior. I mean, seriously, a true story about a beheaded woman, bloody Halloween candy, is far more creepy and chilling than some fake serial killer. And why would he lick your hand? My daughter also felt that story was pathetic because she hates anything in which a dog gets hurt or dies. People is one thing, but pets is just too far. And that brings us to the end of the episode. I hope you learned something, like never trust your neighbors. And I hope you were entertained. And finally, once again, happy Halloween from Mayhem in the Morgue. Until the next time.
This is an iHeart podcast. guaranteed human.